You're listening to Cattails.
Hi, and welcome to another edition of Cattails. Peggy Seeger is totally unique. A singer of traditional Anglo-American songs, she has carved a special niche for herself on both sides of the Atlantic and is considered to be one of the most influential folk singers of all time. Classically trained, Peggy plays no less than 6 musical instruments, has recorded 23 solo albums, contributed to more than 100 others, and her partner, the late Ewan McColl, wrote "First Time Ever I Saw Your Face" in her honour. A well-known activist, she uses music to broadcast her messages on nuclear, ecological and feminist issues, and now at almost 85, she continues to perform and still has something new to say. This is The One with Peggy Seeger.
So how are you feeling with your wrist, isn't it? You've hurt your wrist?
What have you done? Well, I'm on steroids. Oh. They're trying to bring it down. It's a non-rheumatoid inflammatory arthritis. And it was brought on by stress with doing too much weeding with the left hand.
Oh, no, really. That's ironic, isn't it, with all the music playing that you do with your banjo and piano.
Yeah, well, it'll be a week or two before I can play again.
Oh, you poor thing.
Poor me.
Yeah, poor you. But actually, if you're going to do it, now's the time to do it, isn't it, really? Because, you know, your tour hasn't started, has it now, because of the circumstances we're in?
No. I don't even know if it'll happen next year. I have no idea.
Well, we're playing it all by ear, I think, at the moment, aren't we?
I'm afraid we are. Although I think the scientists are moving faster than they were expected to.
Yeah.
They're talking about having a trial of vaccine by September.
Wow, be good if we could, wouldn't it, really?
But oh my God, I'd like to get out.
Oh yes, I bet it's.
Well, I can get out, but I can only get out when, you know, at dusk, when there's not so many people on the streets, because a lot of them just refuse to share. They walk 3 abreast, and you have to really move into the edges of the road to get away from them.
Mostly men
will not share.
Well, you see,
and that's so interesting.
Yeah, it's a good observation, really. I mean, you've been making these observations all your life about the differences with the two sexes, haven't you?
Yeah. I'm just reading a review of what's her name's book about Hillary Clinton.
Oh, yeah.
And it sounds really interesting, because I've always had great respect for Hillary Clinton, and I think she's had a really rotten deal. So this sounds like an interesting book, and it's talking about the differences between her and Bill, how Bill has managed his way through doing really nefarious things with charm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But you see, if a woman did that, then she would be, you know, looked upon gravely, wouldn't she?
Yes, so, manipulative.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing, isn't it? And I think this is a theme, really, that's run through your entire career, hasn't it, of being the sort of the observer, the one who's spoken out. You've been called an activist, obviously, with everything that you've been, you know, been doing. Do you think that's a fair analysis of you?
No. I didn't start really speaking out till I became a feminist. I was following Ewan McColl for the first decade of our being together, maybe 15 years of our being together, and you know, the movement politics are definitely masculine-based, big industry, huge organizations, Marxism, da-da-da-da. And, you know, we often had arguments about whether, you know, women should gain liberation before the revolution or after the revolution, as if the revolution was ever going to come. And I was a radical feminist. I said, we need to liberate women now so that our vote counts.
Yeah.
And Ewan would say, no, you know, it's not the most important issue. So, and they weren't stand up, sit down arguments, but I followed his lead pretty much for the first 15 years. And when I came over here when I was 20, I was already aware of the big issues in industry, unionism, and all of the murders taking place in the South, and you know, the state of America's economy, which I knew very little about, but which I had instinctive feelings about. Mm. Instinctive, because I sang songs that were from the working class.
Yeah.
The middle class don't make up folk songs. They don't do it. No. It's something that the working class, it's a working class feature.
Yeah. It's interesting that, isn't it? It's like, you know, I often think about this with history. You know, history is written by those who are in either a powerful situation or who are the victors. It doesn't tell the story of the people who have either been persecuted or have lost a battle or who were not in favour at that time. And in a way, the folk music has been their voice, hasn't it?
Yeah, their only voice. The thing is that the working classes, for the most part, in America anyway, were not literate. They tended to be more so here, especially in Scotland, because of the Calvinists who taught the Bibles, taught people how to read. But in America, an awful lot of people in the backwoods were not literate. So the lessons were taught by folk music. The news was spread by folk music. The entertainment was there by folk music. It was the only thing they had until the radio, because they didn't have visiting orchestras or opera or anything like that. And unless you lived in a big town, and unless you had the money, you couldn't go and hear musical shows or anything like that. So it was pretty much... I don't know if you're following these shows I'm doing on Sundays.
Yes.
Peggy at 5 on Sunday. Every Sunday I do 15 or 20 minutes of singing and just talking. And because I've hurt my hand, I'm doing it unaccompanied at the moment. And the next one's going to be a patchwork quilt of small songs that I never, ever sing on stage or in public because they're so small and they're so trivial. And yet you put them all together and it shows a way of life, little things like somebody's horse being stolen, like a method of courtship in the mountains, things like that, you know.
That's wonderful.
And so folk music, in a way, showed me as a middle-class American woman brought up in what they called the intelligentsia. This was an eye-opener, all this. And I learned it from the time I was 2.
Blimey. That's a young age to be exposed to that, really, isn't it? And to have that awareness of the fact of the importance of being able to tell those stories and to be able to speak out.
Well, I think all of us kids got it. You identified with the chain gangs. You identified with the single mothers left with babies in their arms. You identified with the economic carnage. You know?
Wow.
Because it was on a personal basis. The singers, you saw the singers in your head.
Yeah, so if you're around this at an early age, it actually infiltrates your very being, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. Yeah, so it wasn't that I became an activist. I probably, from the very beginning, had the basis, the necessary basis for an activist, which is identifying in some way, however distant or however seemingly trivial or however, I don't know the right word, identifying with the bulk of the people,
yeah,
which are the people who do the work at the very bottom, what we call key workers.
Absolutely, yes.
Yeah.
Who were all of
I like the term. I like the term.
I like that term. I think it's lovely that they're now starting to be recognised, and it's only when you have a bit of a crisis going on that you appreciate that everybody is equal and everybody's got very important roles to play, whatever they're doing.
Yeah.
Yeah. So although that may not have been sort of like in your forefront to be, like, say, an activist, though, let's use that label, but you have had a very unconventional life, from the outside, me reading in. Do you feel that you have, or has that just been, something that's happened by fate?
Well, I'm essentially a selfish person. I do what I want to do. Mm-hmm. And some of it has been dangerous, like riding a Lambretta scooter from New York to Chicago when I'm only 20, which was a damn fool, stupid thing to do. And some people, they fall in love with a married man who has a wife and children, and they choose not to take him away. Although I didn't choose to take him away, it was his choice.
Yeah.
You know, but I wasn't going to continue on the edges of it. That was not my idea. But I chose. You know, I know people who have fallen madly in love with someone, and they have a wife and 5 kids, and they choose to ignore the love affair and go back to the wife and kids.
Yeah.
which, for whatever reason, remembering what it feels like to be in love, really in love, I think is heroic, to forego a love affair that you feel is so basic. So I do more or less what I have had a very selfish life. And because I was selfish, I've ended up at the age of 85 still able to sing and still having my own personality, because it's easy to get swallowed up in family, swallowed up in a marriage, swallowed up by the things people think you should do. I just never paid attention to what people thought.
You see, you call that selfishness. I don't necessarily see that as you being selfish, Peggy. I see that as being you a very strong, independent woman who knows her own mind.
Well, it meant that I hurt people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that maybe... But, you know, sometimes I felt hurt myself.
Yes.
And you're trying to mend yourself.
Yeah, and unfortunately, I don't think you can go through the entire life anyway without hurting somebody, can you? Because if you don't hurt somebody along the way, you actually end up hurting yourself.
Possibly, yeah, that's a way of looking at it.
Yeah, it's tricky. So I think you're being a bit hard on yourself there, Peggy, I have to say. But I'll take it if that's how you view it. But
term activist, though, Kat, I regard myself as a... Well, I've done quite a lot of demonstrating, and I've been arrested once. I've lost a tooth and I've lost glasses in demonstrations. But for the most part, when you consider what some of the activists have done, you know, with going to prison for 10, 15 years, enduring torture and being taken away from their families, seeing their families murdered, activists... I sometimes feel as if I'm a kind of a genteel activist. Writing a song is not a difficult thing to do.
Yeah. Well, I think it's quite a difficult thing to do, not being able to write one, Peggy. So, you know, it's all the way that you... It depends how you look at it, doesn't it? And, you know, and we've talked there about how important folk music is. So to have that voice, in a way, it's a little bit like the media is today, isn't it? So that skill that you have in being able to tell that story, to make people think, to influence them, is actually really powerful. And I don't think that's easy at all.
Right. Well, maybe not easy, but, you know, compared to what some activists have done in putting themselves on the front line.
Yeah, it's not as dangerous, maybe, but I think the influence is possibly more far-reaching or equally as far-reaching.
Well, it's different. It's a different kind of influence.
Exactly. Yeah, it is, really. So, you know, that writing of your, you know, your music and saying that word and obviously performing some of those songs that haven't been performed for years, you know, you are still doing that at, you know, the age of, you know...
Nearly 85.
A mature lady. You've obviously still got that passion. Do you feel that you've still got something to say then, or is it just now that you enjoy the performance?
Oh, no, there's plenty to say. Mm. There's lots to say. We have a new album that's finished that was going to go along on the tour. It's not going to appear till January.
Yeah.
You know, there's no point bringing an album out now. But it's a family album. It's called First Farewell. I've written 6 of the 13 songs myself, and the other songs are written with my son Callum, my son Neil, and my daughter-in-law Kate.
Yeah.
And everyone has been involved in the singing and involved in the accompaniments, so it's completely the first real family album I've made since I was 20.
Oh, wow.
And I made it with my birth family. So I'm really looking forward to that, because what it does, because this does actually bear on the question that we were talking about, is that it approaches the making of songs about modern issues, which there are songs on this. It's mostly contemporary issues, but not making direct political comment, trying to spread the understanding of how we come to be the way we are and making correlations, let's say. For instance, the correlation between a love affair and a couple sitting in a bar room, both of them looking at their phones.
Yes.
You know? And the song is called We Are Here. And it's it's an observation with two voices talking about, and it's not saying, oh, we shouldn't be on our phones. Well, you'd have to, when the time comes, you couldn't hear it. But And it's a format that I haven't used before, partly speaking and partly singing.
Right.
And there's another one called Lubrication, which begins sounding very sleazy, and so you immediately think of one form of lubrication. And then it turns out to be completely different. It turns out to be an ecological song.
Right.
You know. So it's trying to approach making modern songs so that people want to sing them if they are not mad activists.
Yes.
You know, so singing about the situation and moving the mental interconnections on, that's what I'm trying to do right now.
Well, Peggy, why don't we just take a quick break in our conversation to listen to a beautiful track of yours called Gotta Get Home by Midnight.
When I wake up in the morning, I'm 100 years old. My feet on the floor and I'm 99. A good hot shower and I'm looking at 80. After breakfast, I'm 79. Getting younger by the hour, gotta get home by midnight. It's a beautiful day, I'm 64 in my new red shoes. My kitchen is a dance floor. Lunchtime and I'm in my prime, 50 and I'm heading for 49. Getting younger by the hour, gotta get home by midnight. An hour ago I was 41, I said I was 39. But now I'm 20 heading for my teens, hormones driving me out of my mind. If I stay any longer I'll be buying those blue jeans, the ones manufactured with the holes all over. Getting younger by the hour, gotta get home by midnight. When the clock strikes 12, nature resumes her own gravitational plan. Then I'm hitting the road with Father Time dragging me by the hand. But I'm gonna leave a little glass slipper behind before the rats start pulling my van. Getting younger by the hour, gotta get home by midnight. Prince Charming is standing there. He gazed into my blue eyes. He said they're the color of time. He knelt down by my chair, and that little glass slipper just fitted me fine. He's waiting for me now in the moonlight. He said, come home whenever you like. I want to run my hands through his curly gray hair. So good night, I gotta get home.
Hello, I'm Peggy Seeger, and I'm listening to Cat Tales.
With all your music and just, you know, having the conversations that I have with you over the times, Peggy, what I find is that you've not only got that challenging thought process, but you're able to articulate it, which is the most important thing.
Yeah. Well, if I'm unique in any way, it's in two things. The first thing is that I got my musical education from the two parameters, the edges of music, one working class music and the other classical music. My weak points are the ones in between, the popular music, the music hall music, and the top 20, what used to be called the top 20 or the hit parade and all that. So I know musically what I'm doing because I had a classical education. I can write it all down on a score pad. And the other thing is that I learned the other side of the parameter is that I learned, I think, as a middle class Washington D.C. person, how to sing folk songs without being an imitator, or without parodying. So So that's the first way that I might be considered unique, in that I know what I'm doing when I don't sing folk music exactly the way somebody sitting on their Appalachian cabin door. And I create some songs that are so complicated that they might as well be classical.
Yes.
So I have the two edges. So that's the first thing. And the second thing was that I might be considered unique is that I had Ewan McCall in my life. Mm-hmm. And I have Irene Piper Scott in my life. Mm-hmm. Two excellent life partners, 30 years each at this point. And with Ewan, I got a theatrical education.
Yeah.
Understanding what it is to give a concert where you're singing, actually singing for 2 hours, and you just have to get out of your comfort zone so as to keep people awake. So you have to do this kind of song, then that kind of song, then another kind of song, then this kind of song, so that people's ears and attention are always kind of surprised.
Yeah.
So that they're not hypnotized. I mean, there's some wonderful singers. And for the most part, they follow their comfort zone.
Yeah.
Everything is fast, loud, major, lasting 4 minutes with a band, etc. And then the next one is loud, 4 minutes, yeah, major. And the result on the whole in pop music at the big concerts is that that appeals to the adrenaline of people. And they carry that adrenaline on themselves, and they build up and they build up and they build up. That isn't what I try to do in a concert. Yeah. I try to make their minds move from this to that to this, to make the heart involved here, to make them want to cry there, make them want to laugh there. A short piece that's 15 seconds long, and the next one is a piece that I made about a Marine who deserted in Iraq that's 7 minutes long.
Yeah.
So creating an atmosphere where people will follow you wherever you choose to take them theatrically.
Mm.
I got that from working with Ewan and our group, the Critics Group, for 6 or 7 years. And for actually taking part in theatrical productions. So I have had an extraordinary education.
Yeah.
That's and interesting. I can talk about it because I listened to Ewan McCall talk for 30 years and I never said a word.
Mm.
And when he died, I started talking. Mm. And I find that sometimes I'm mimicking things that he was teaching and things that I've, started working at myself. And the fact that I don't have a beautiful voice helps. I have a character voice. I don't have a Joan Baez voice. I don't have a Judy Collins voice. There was a time when I wanted them, but now I wouldn't, because with a character voice, you have to keep creating in a way that you don't have to when you have a beautiful voice. When you have a beautiful voice, you only need to sing.
Yeah.
And they do it beautifully. Boy, do they do it beautifully. But I can't do that.
That sounds like you admire them in a different way to the type of
work
that
I do.
Mm.
Well, I do. Part of me would just love to have had, I would have loved to have had Jean Ritchie's voice.
Right.
I don't know if you knew her. She sang about 2 octaves higher than I can.
Wow.
And I kept trying to make my voice do what hers did. Folk singer.
Uh-huh.
But that's the only voice she had. I have a number of voices, or I used to before I got so old. I can't, there's things I can't sing properly anymore. But I'm loving my lower range. Oh boy, I am.
Well, yeah. Sounds like you're absolutely embracing what nature has given you along the way in all respects,
yes, I am,
of your life.
Yeah,
and the description that you gave there about what Ewan taught you is actually how to take the audience on an emotional journey.
Exactly, exactly, exactly.
And when you start,
and you sit up there on stage, and you've done this song and then that song, and you're wondering what to do next, and you throw yourself out to the audience, and you say, "If I was sitting out there, what would I want to hear next?"
Mm.
I think I described one of the most extraordinary experiences I've had in a long time. That happened, in, I think it would have been in the early 2000s or maybe late 1990s in Prince, in Provincetown in Rhode Island, where I was part of a concert that involved four other acts. Mm-hmm. The first one was a women's drumming group, and the first was a fellow named Oscar Brand, who was very funny and kind of informal, an easy singer, and he brought them into the evening. It was a bunch of students, university students, almost all men. Uh-huh. So there's Oscar Brand, and he comes on, and he does very funny songs, some of them student songs that they know. And then there's a women's drumming group. They're like Boadicea, and they're hopping up and down on the stage, and the din is unbelievable. Mm. And then, God help me, there's me. Oh. And these men are going crazy. They're standing up and they're dancing and da-da-da. And then on comes me, and I would have been about 70 at that time, mm-hmm. maybe 65, 68. And I thought, if I was any human being right now, what would I need? And what they needed was not more drumming. Yeah. They needed quiet. They needed to sit down and start breathing again. And so I thought, what I'd really like is, they need mama, yeah. you know? Mm-hmm. So I just started describing what was happening in Iraq, and I tied it to a woman being stolen away from during the border reavers, the border in Scotland.
Yeah.
And then sang a 9-minute unaccompanied ballad.
Wow, beautiful.
And they just were as quiet as mice.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, and there's a lesson there. Mm. It could have fallen totally flat on its face, but it didn't.
Yeah.
You know? So I did my 45-minute session, and then I did a thing with the banjo, and I talked about the instruments and gave them some variety of other stuff and something they could sing and howl with. And so I prepared the program for Richie Havens, who was next.
Amazing.
And so it was a perfect, he got a good audience ready to rave again. No, so you figure out, if I was in the audience, what would I want?
Yeah. Did you actually go on and change your repertoire to fit with that moment because you weren't?
Oh, you do every time.
Right.
You do every time. You don't. I only go on with a set list now with my sons so that they know what to expect.
Sure.
I never made set lists back then. You just sang what you felt was right for the next one, next song.
Brilliant. That's so intuitive with our audience. And so, you know, observing that, that must end up being a far greater experience than just coming on and giving them what you want to play.
No, it's not greater. It's just different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's just different, 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 different.
Yeah.
And sometimes the audiences now, I think we need controlled orgies at present. And I think that's what a lot of the pop concerts are. I think they're controlled riots.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I would not want to be up there singing in any way in front of a crowd like that. They're looking for something else.
Yeah, yeah.
And they won't listen to the words, and they won't, no. That's not what they're there for. Mm. They're there to have a community experience and to sway with each other. So rather than saying I've had an extraordinary life, you might say I've had a unique life, but then probably so have you. We don't know what other people's lives are like.
Yeah.
And looking at other people, we always feel, oh, they had this extraordinary experience. That's different from mine. And we sometimes do ourselves down and our lives down when we compare them with other people's.
Yeah.
And that's a wrong thing to do.
Yeah, it is. You're absolutely right. You're a very, very wise woman, Peggy. And I'm glad that you're still putting all that on paper and into songs and bringing it to people to listen. You know, and I've been very privileged to talk to you in your life today, and that's been lovely. Thank you very much.
Okay, Kat.
Speak soon, Peggy. Right. You take care. Thank you.
And same to you. Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Cattails.
To listen again to this and other tales, go to cattails.co.uk.